Hi, this is David Inge again, welcoming you to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I think it's now the 34th time we've said that. Glad to have you listening this morning. Back here after some vacation. I'll figure out how to do this. It'll only take me a few days. Rick Karch is with us this morning to talk about car care. He's the owner of Rick's Automotive in Champaign. And generally, we try to have him here once each season, every few months, to talk about car problems. So if you're having some kind of a problem, give us a call. Tell us what kind of car it is. Give us the best description of the symptoms. And he will see if he can help you out, at least suggest what you can look at. And if you have more kind of general questions about maintenance issues, safety issues, anything like that, I'm sure he'll do his best to try to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Sure.
Appreciate it. I just was thinking about how not very long ago I took in my car for an oil change, took it to the dealership, and as they do, they put a little sticker on your window that says when they think you should come back for the next change. And I guess I was a little surprised, maybe I'm not paying enough attention, that how long the interval is, you know, how long they're telling me I could go before the next oil change. Are the intervals, as now we have new models of cars, are the intervals starting to getting longer than they used to be?
Well, a lot of times, was it 7,500?
Yeah, it was maybe 4 months and 7,000 miles or something like that. Yeah.
With they probably use a synthetic-based oil.
Could be.
And that does increase the interval. And you can run that up to 7,500 miles.
So it is an oil, depending on what kind of oil it is, that can mean that you can go that much longer.
Yes, and obviously if you do a lot of short driving where the engine never really gets up to operating temperature for a prolonged period of time, you should step up the oil change intervals, because that moisture that's in the oil never gets warm enough to evaporate, and then of course breaks the oil down prematurely. But yeah, you're right, the intervals have changed. A lot of times they do that. It helps with advertising. You know, it's X amount of dollars per mile to operate this vehicle, and that all equates into that number.
Sometimes I get a little confused, or I guess I'm not sure what to say if I go in there and they say, well, what kind of oil do you want? And I'm thinking, well, I don't know. Don't you know? Shouldn't you be able to tell me what kind of oil I should have? Does it really make very much difference? I suppose you wouldn't want to buy the cheapest possible oil, but then there are also high-performance synthetic oil. Some of them are expensive. There can be a big difference between the cheapest and the most expensive. Does it really matter?
If you can afford the synthetic oil, it's definitely an advantage to use it. It's a lot better in terms of overall protection, particularly when the engine first starts. That's when there's a lot of friction involved. And the synthetic oils, they're upwards of $6, $7 a quart, depending on what people charge for it. Conventional oil is, maybe $2.50 to $2.75, somewhere in there. So there, it's a pretty significant difference. If you put synthetic oil in a car, you can run an oil change up to almost $100 by the time you're out the door.
Yeah. Now, how much oil? I know there also can be a big difference in how much oil a car holds.
Yes, there is.
What's the average number of quarts now?
Typically, I'd say it's around 4.5 to 5 quarts. Some, as you mentioned, it varies. Some are 7.5, 8.5, 12, 14 quarts in some of these cars.
Yeah, okay. We have a couple callers here. We're happy to get to them. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free. 800-222-9455. Someone calling us, they're on the road, they're near Effingham on the toll-free line. We'll go there. This is line 4. Hello.
Hi, my name's Justin, and I'm from St. Louis. And I was wondering about, I do a lot of driving. I drive probably 50,000 miles a year. Aside from keeping my tires properly inflated and keeping my oil regularly changed, is there anything that I need to do that's special to keep my car going?
Just follow the specified mileage interval maintenance services that's in your owner's manual.
Okay, so just all the maintenances, all the tune-ups,
right,
intervals that they recommend, do all of that, and I should be able to get the most out of my car?
Correct.
All right, thank you.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Thank you. Next is line one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 90 Subaru Legacy, and I'm having a problem with the driver's side shoulder belt. It snagged up one time, and now it doesn't activate when you start the car and all that. I was just wondering, is there a separate motor for each side? The passenger side works properly, but the driver's side doesn't.
Yes, each side has its own motor.
Where would that be located, roughly?
It's when you, it's in the B pillar, but the A pillar is the angled post that goes next to the windshield, between the windshield and the driver's door there at the front.
Okay.
And then the post that runs is behind your left shoulder there.
Uh-huh.
That's the B pillar. Inside that B pillar, there's a, under the cover, down at the bottom is where that motor is for that, I call it a mouse, the one that runs along the track across the top.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's where that motor is. The other question, a lot of times with these type of seat belts, when they either work sometimes or they don't work at all, the first thing I look at is when I open the door, does the interior light come on? And if I leave the key in the ignition system, does the buzzer work? And if those aren't working, then the mouse won't work because it doesn't know the door's open. So make sure that those two things are functioning correctly.
The light comes on or the buzzer.
Right, when you open the door.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. On to Urbana. This is the next caller, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question regarding the cleaning of the inside rear window of a car. I know that it has that template for defrosting and so forth, so I want to be kind of delicate, but your thoughts, please.
Just normal window, Windex-type product can be used. One thing that I notice a lot of people do is they put parking stickers back there, and the last thing, when you have to remove those, you should use a hair dryer to warm the sticker up. That grid is very, very delicate back there, as you obviously already know. But just normal glass cleaner and soft towel will be just fine.
Hey, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks. So that the grid that works for the rear window defogger, that's actually laid on the surface of the glass.
Correct.
Okay, so you do want to make sure that you don't rip that, damage it, pull it off.
Yeah, because if you break one strip, that strip won't function, and depending on how many strips go across it. Now, there are products out there that actually work quite well. It's a paint, but it's very, very metallic paint.
Mm-hmm.
And you clean the surface where the break is, and you put like masking tape on each side, and then you paint between the two pieces of masking tape and join that section back together. It works pretty good.
So you can fix it up.
You can fix some of them. Some of them, they just get so deteriorated from heating, cooling, and sun and age that sometimes really the only option is to replace the window.
So you can't just scrape that off and lay a new one of those things on. You have to put in a whole new window.
There are aftermarket ones out there, but I don't recommend doing that. But the biggest thing, like I mentioned, is if you're going to have to put a sticker in the rear window, try to find somewhere where it doesn't lay over those defogger lines.
Mm-hmm.
They just look like either black or brown lines going across the rear window.
All right. Rick Karch is with us this morning from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He is here on the program every few months. We talk about car care. If you have a problem or a question, call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Paris, line 3. Hello.
I'd like to know, if you don't drive your car very much, how much is the minimum that you should drive a car to keep it functioning? Is it once a month or once every 2 months or what?
Well, what is your normal driving habits?
Well, I drive it a whole lot more in the summer, but in the winter, I kind of park it and don't drive it very much.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to keep it running.
Well, when the car sits, the number one thing to do is fill the gas tank and keep the gas tank as full as possible.
Keep the gas tank full, okay.
Yes, keep that full.
Uh-huh.
And
what's the next thing?
The next thing would be, if you're not going to use the car for a period of time, maybe...
Well, I would, it's available. I would drive it if it would help it. You know what I mean? I just don't, how much is a minimum I should drive it to keep it going?
Well, it could sit for 2 weeks if
2 weeks, every 2 weeks?
Sure, that would be fine. I mean, it's not really...
And then how far should I drive it in those 2 weeks? Can I just drive it a couple of miles or...
No, you need to drive it at least 10 or 15 minutes.
10 or 15 miles? Oh, that's a lot more than I thought.
No, I said for 10 or 15 minutes.
Minutes.
10 or 15 miles.
No. For,
time. Time.
Time. He was saying for at least drive around for at least 10 or 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Is what Rick's saying.
Oh, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Not 10 or 15 miles, 15 minutes.
Right.
Okay. And can that be slow?
No, it
traveling
can be,
in town slowly
that's fine.
At 30 miles an hour, or should that be swifter?
No, that's fine. In town is fine.
Okay.
What you're trying to do is get everything up to operating temperature.
Yeah.
Particularly the exhaust system, the moisture that collects in the exhaust. You want to get that removed.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in that period of time,
mm-hmm.
that should be adequate.
The moisture, yeah.
Right.
Okay. And what about the electrical system? It would boost that again, too, wouldn't it, that 15 miles?
Yeah, I would charge minutes. That battery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, 10 or 15 minutes.
Correct.
Instead of miles. I thank you very much. You've been most helpful.
All right, well, thank you. It really is cars, as you say, they like to be driven. They need to be driven. And if they sit for a long period of time, maybe you'll have trouble. Same kind of issue applies to if you're only going to drive short trips, like we do, for example. We probably only maybe put 10 or 15 miles on the car every day, and they are very short trips. Is there anything, if that's just the kind of driving that you're going to do, other than, as we talked about earlier, you might want to increase the frequency of your oil change? Is there anything else that you can do for the car to try to guarantee it a longer life if most of what it's getting is short trips?
No, it's a good idea every once in a while to maybe drive a little longer, get up a little earlier, run an errand on the way home or something like that, because those short trips are, as we've mentioned, again, back to the condensation and the moisture, and mm-hmm. That's what's hard on things, and particularly people, they'll say, well, I have to buy an exhaust every 2 years. Well, as soon as they say that, I know exactly what their driving habits are.
Yeah.
They're 1 or 2 miles, they shut it off. And they start it up 1 or 2 miles, and it's just repetitive like that.
Because you get water vapor comes out with the exhaust.
Right.
And
collects in there.
And if you drive enough, the pipe gets hot. It evaporates off,
right.
But if you're only going a few miles, it never does, and that water stays in there, and eventually mm-hmm. it just rusts it right out.
Correct.
So if you can, just take every once in a while, just go out and take a little longer drive,
yeah,
I guess.
That's all.
All right. Let's talk with somebody in Charleston. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
My name is Dave. I'm from Charleston. I've got a 98 Dodge Dakota. And about every 2 weeks, I've got to add grease to my driver's side ball joint. Now, I can't find a rip anywhere in the rubber sleeve of that ball joint, and I don't know, should I get that replaced, or is it normal to have to replace grease that quickly?
How do you determine when to add grease? You just...
It'll start squeaking, and I just add grease and it stops squeaking.
Oh, it squeaks. Oh, yeah, it needs to be replaced.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, to another caller here. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a 1997 Pontiac Bonneville, and I have an intermittent problem with the interior lights and the power door locks. Most of the time it's off these days, but the little light by my power window adjustments stays on. And so does, and my power windows work, but most of the time the interior lights and the power door locks don't work. Occasionally they both come on at the same time, But when they're working or when they're not working, it's always together. I never have one working and one not working.
Meaning?
Where to look.
Okay, when you say both, you're talking the interior lights and the power door locks?
Correct.
Okay. And...
But the power windows do work all the time. And the little lights next to the power window adjustment on the armrest of the door, those are also working mm-hmm. all the time.
Well, I'm trying to think what would be related, because the interior light, as far as the locks are concerned, all locks are inoperative?
Correct.
Okay. The next time that happens, if you move the lever, the lock-unlock lever, back and forth, as you slowly open and close the door mm-hmm. and see if it starts to work. Where the door jamb is, the wires, every time you open the door, the wires are being flexed.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll get, the insulation will crack off the exterior. They may touch one another. They may partially break, and the insulation is all that's holding it together.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the interior lights are concerned, I'm not sure on a 97 Bonneville if the switch for the interior lights is part of the door latch or if there's actually a button in the door jamb area. But if it's part of the latch, it may all be related to what I just described earlier
mm-hmm.
as far as the wires in the door jamb.
Okay.
There's a rubber boot when you open the driver's door all the way. You'll see an accordion-looking type
right.
boot there. If you pull that away from the door or the chassis either way and just kind of start sliding it, and squeezing it together, you'll be able to see those wires in there.
Okay.
And you might look in there first.
All right. All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. All right. I was wondering if they might have a common ground or something that was coming loose.
Well.
But my wiring schematic doesn't show anything.
No, I wouldn't think. Generally with electrical problems that are intermittent, if you have a ground problem, it's a ground problem.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't come and go.
Okay.
In other words, it's not changing. But okay. My first reaction is to look at those wires in that door jamb.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Our guest again here this morning, Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He is generally here. We ask him to be with us once a season. So I guess this would be our fall show to give you the opportunity to call and ask questions about car issues. If you're having a problem, give us the best description, and he'll see if he can help you out. Also, other more general kind of questions that have to do with maintenance and safety and any and all of that, you can certainly give us a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We're really not at winter yet, but we're headed that direction, and I think one of the things that's probably important to make sure that your wiper blades are in good shape. You know, maybe you can handle that if it's raining and not too hard, if they don't do a very good job. But it's probably one of those things that it does turn out to be a safety feature, if not a nuisance, if they're not clearing off really well enough. How what sort of life would you expect to get out of a set of wiper blades?
Well, depending on the environment in which you live, I mean, if you live in St. Louis or Chicago and there's a obviously, every time it rains, the dirt and chemicals that are contained within the rain as it falls end up on the windshield into the wiper blades. And you can increase the life of wiper blades significantly if you just, when you wash the car, if you wash the wiper blades. Just take a towel and just clean the blades. You'd be amazed how dirty they get. But I don't know that there really is an answer to the age. I think a lot of it depends on the quality of the blades you buy. I've had a lot of good luck with the Teflon blades. They seem to last a lot longer than the conventional rubber type blades. You should buy a name brand wiper blade. And anymore, I buy what they refer to as exact fit. Years ago, you used to buy them, and you'd buy the wiper blades, and there's a box full of all these adapters, and you had to figure out which one belonged on your car and was the right width and clipped correctly. So I just buy exact fit, put them on, and it's a done deal. And most part stores will do it for you. If you walk in and say, hey, I need some wiper blades, can you help me put them on? Mm-hmm. And usually they'll help you do that.
Yeah. So that can be the kind of thing that probably a lot of people could do for themselves. Otherwise, it's not that big a deal to get somebody to.
Yeah, just ask somebody to help you.
Yeah. If they're dirty, can that really affect how well they do at doing their job?
Yes.
Okay. So you might, if you're thinking about replacing your blades, maybe you might just first try cleaning them and then seeing, does that make a difference?
Yeah, you can try to clean them. Generally, when they start to chatter or hop on the windshield, that usually means that they're not very pliable anymore. They're stiff. If they leave streaks, it's usually an indication that either the rubber has separated in one area or another. Probably the best thing to do when you buy a new set of wiper blades after you put them on, just feel how the blade feels as far as the flexibility of it. And then you'll kind of have a sense from that when it's time. But like you said, when they don't clean very well, you should just probably just replace them.
Okay. Other callers here. Next, someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. Or I guess morning still.
Yeah, still.
I've got a 2003 Dodge Caravan, and when the gas level gets low, the fuel pump makes a whining sound. Should I get that looked at, or is that a typical response to low gas level?
When you say low, do you mean
quarter tank, something like that?
Well, it's got over 100,000 on it?
No, it's got about 36,000 on it.
The rest of the time it's perfectly quiet?
Yep.
Yeah, I would probably have it looked at. Have you run it real low on gas before?
Well, I mean, just...
down to E?
No, that low.
No, okay. Yeah, sometimes those pumps will do that. Sometimes it has to do with where the actual pickup is. It could be a problem with the rubber hose from the pump down to the actual pickup screen. Gas tank has to come out to do that, of course.
Yep. But anyhow, it's under warranty. Can I take it in and say fix it? Or?
Well, you could describe to them what you just mentioned as far as when the gas level gets down to a quarter or less, that it becomes extremely noisy. And whether they fix it the day you bring it in or not, I mean, I would bring it in with the gas level at that point so they can actually hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And when cars are under warranty, it's a good idea, even though it may seem kind of trivial to you at the time, to make sure that a comment or a problem you're experiencing, if it's intermittent in particular, is noted somewhere in the paperwork so that a month or 2 months later, if you have the same complaint again, you can say, well, look, you know, the last time I was in, I had the same issue, but it was intermittent, and now this time I have a little more information for you as far as how to diagnose it or maybe help you find the problem. And that's always real beneficial. So I would take it in when the gas level's low, when it's making that noise. And when you make the appointment and show up for it, ask them if they'll come out and listen to it while you're there so you can specifically say, this is the noise I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm. Well, okey-doke. Well, thank you.
Sure. All right. Thanks. Thanks for the call. So fuel pumps are actually in the gas tank.
And a lot of cars. Right?
And a lot of tanks. So that means if you got some kind of problem, then you actually have to pull the
gas tank
out of the car.
Fortunately, some of the import manufacturers will actually create an access hole, a panel, mm-hmm. which just has four Phillips screws. Mm-hmm. And you can take that panel off, and then you can take the sending unit out. It's a combination on most cars. It's the fuel pump and the sending unit. And some of these products, you can buy just the pump. Some you have to buy the whole assembly. So, I mean, the part price for a fuel pump can vary from, say, $80 to $480. It's a huge variance in pricing because of the way it's designed. So it's not a good idea to run them low on gas because the gas is what lubricates the pump. And if you repeatedly run it low on gas and you go around a corner and the fuel moves to the opposite side from the pickup tube or the pickup screen and the pump runs dry, every time that happens, it's stressing the pump and mm-hmm. the bearings, and it will prematurely fail.
So how much gasoline would you suggest people try to keep in there as a steady level?
Well, I don't...
Or is that?
A lot of that depends on pocketbook. You know, some people, they just always drive till the light comes on, and then they put $4 or $5 in, and they drive it till the light comes on. So,
would a quarter a tank
I think
be,
if you kept it above a quarter tank, it would be well protected. Yes.
Well, I suppose also in the, particularly in the wintertime, you want to, you don't want the gas to run low because you got your problem with water vapor building up in the tank, and then that can cause you problems with the engine.
Yes, you get water in the
fuel line, right?
Yes.
So if you can, it's probably a good idea, at least in the wintertime, to have more than a half a tank.
I would say so, yes. That would be good. Yeah. So maybe in the winter you pretend half is E, but sometimes that's hard to do.
All right. Well, yeah, especially at today's prices. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Terre Haute next, line four. Hello?
Yeah, I've got a 94 Toyota 4Runner, and I get excessive heat in the passenger compartment coming up between the seats, and also the hood after the car runs is just hot as can be. And last maintenance go round, they checked it out. It doesn't overheat. It runs, you know, normal temperature. Everything is fine. The heat shields are in place, and I wonder if you had any idea as to what would cause this kind of effect.
Well, as far as the hood getting hot, that's going to happen. I mean,
well, friends have noted, for instance, a half hour after, you know, when we're just looking around, and they, you can only put your hand on the hood, it just really heats up excessively and stays hot.
Well, I don't. Yeah, does it still have the hood mat underneath?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. And as far as this heat getting up between the seats, my first reaction is it four-wheel drive, so it's got the shift lever down there on the floor?
Yeah.
My first reaction would be that that heat is radiating up through that. And if they have like a smoke machine, which is a machine that, just like it sounds, it develops a smoke, and you would just simply place that in that tunnel area under the car and then get in the vehicle, and you would see the smoke coming into the car if there was a leak. But if you put your hand down in that area, particularly the carpet area, you can, you can kind of, as you move your hand around, I would think that it would get warmer as you got closer to that boot area, which is already a hole.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a boot, then there's an insulation material, and then there's another cover underneath that too. And maybe that's been off at one time. Maybe it's torn. Maybe it's not in the right place.
Well, the hottest spot, actually, I'm doing it right now as you're speaking, and up around the gear shift lever and the four-wheel drive lever is less hot than about a foot, 18 inches behind it, right about at the seat, right where your butt is. It's just... And down there, it's just really hot to touch again.
That's the hottest area?
Yeah, on that plastic cover. I just wonder if there's anything, this has happened. This has been going on for, you know, months and months and months.
Okay, then the next thing would be to have someone check the, you have a check engine light on?
No, and there are no computer codes.
Okay. Would be to check the catalytic converter, inlet and outlet temperatures.
Okay.
You may have an issue with the catalytic converter, but they can do that with an infrared heat gun.
Okay.
Yeah, you can check temperature in, temperature out. But I would still do the smoke machine just to verify that there's no leaks there.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. On to Rantoul. This is line one. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 1992 Buick Roadmaster, and I have a current draw with all the fuses out from the door side panel of 0.17 of an amp, and it's killed the battery on me. It just started occurring. What do I do next, and where can I get a book other than the Haynes manual to help me do some electrical troubleshooting?
Okay, so what's the amperage draw again?
0.17 of an amp. With my digital voltmeter taken at the battery. That's with all the fuses out of the fuse panel and the driver's side door thing.
Okay, then. And that only has one fuse box on the car?
I can't find any other ones.
Okay.
That Haynes manual says there's supposed to be one under the hood, and right. I sure can't find it.
Okay. There's a company called All Data, A-L-L-D-A-T.
Data, yeah. Yeah.
They're
on the computer. I saw that.
Yes.
That costs money.
Correct. Yeah, if you can't find anything at the library.
Yeah.
But drains are sometimes difficult. You have to, obviously, what you've already done, then you have to then start at the alternator, disconnect the alternator.
I've done that.
Okay. Does it have a power antenna?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Is the antenna go up and down correctly?
Yes.
All right.
It's got electric powered trunk. You know, you touch it down there, it pulls it down. I've disconnected that.
Yeah. Then you want to take the bulbs out of, like, the glove box, the trunk, underhood.
That I've not done, but I'll do that.
Underhood light.
Yeah. I'll do that. What I'm trying to figure out is there, if I took out all the fuses in the relays and I'm still getting a current draw, there's got to be another source of fuses or something. Am I correct? What about the computer? As far as I can tell, I'm not sure if the operating engine management system, operating system is separate from that fuse box or not.
Yeah, it's got a constant supply to keep memory in it.
Yeah, so I suspected that.
Right. What kind of radio? Current,
it's just a standard push-button AM with cassette.
Okay.
It's the electronic operating system, you know. You push the button, automatic temperature, and it automatically controls the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
That all seems to be working fine.
Now, you're just going to have to individually disable systems and components.
Okay.
It's just, it's time-consuming.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes you just have to keep plugging away at it.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll eventually get to it. And now when you're measuring this drain, you're disconnecting like the negative cable
at
the battery and putting an amp meter in series?
Correct.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, you're doing it the correct way, so.
Yeah, I'm doing it for the instructions that came with the meter.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the right way. But it'll take time, but you'll find it.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thank
okay,
you.
Bye.
On again to Champagne. Another call.
Hello.
Again. Yes, hi.
Hi. Shortly after we bought, it's a Toyota Sienna 1998, I noticed that part of the dashboard lights weren't showing up. And so we finally had a mechanic go in, and he checked and put a new bulb in. But then it happened again, so I don't think it had anything to do with the bulbs. So gradually we went to a blacked out dashboard except for the drive that lights up. And one day we were at our grandson's and he came out and he said, I know what to do. And he banged on the dashboard and the lights came on. Now, long term, do we need to worry about this or what do you suggest?
Well, you could pull that instrument cluster back out and just clean or retension all of the contacts. When the dash lights go out, do also the lights go out that are over to the right of that where, like, the heater control panel is?
It seemed like it went out little by little to the left where the heater control panel is. Yeah. The whole thing went out eventually.
So everybody went out.
Yeah, except for that middle line that has park reverse.
Right.
And that one thing would show up.
Well, then I would go to the little rheostat, which is like in your dining room that you rotate to change the illumination of the light.
Yeah, we've done that.
Wiggle that back and forth, kind of push it up and down, left and right.
I mean, now it's working after he banged on the dashboard.
Right.
But we thought maybe it would be very expensive to go in there and have that done. So we thought, well, we'll just live with it now that we've got the lights back on.
No, the next time it happens, see if you can get them to come back on. Don't hit the dash. Just try wiggling that rheostat
Well, we've been doing that, and it didn't work.
Okay. All right. Uh-huh. Well, then, the only real way to figure it out at this point is to wait until it's inoperative, and then it can be removed, and you can check.
So you don't suggest just banging the dashboard again and letting it go at that?
I mean, that's that's entirely up to you.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, but it is a safety issue, the ability to know how fast you're going and
well,
see
yeah,
the gauges.
Right.
And
although I did adapt to that.
Yes.
I had little techniques
flashlight.
For that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And other drivers.
Right.
So, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We will continue here. We got about 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Rick Karch is our guest from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's with us several times a year. We talk about car care. So if you're having a problem, you can call and tell him about it, and he'll see if he can help. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And the next person here is in Aurora, Lion 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question, I really don't have a problem yet, but it's something that when your one caller about fuel pumps called in that made me question it. Is there a rough idea of how long a fuel pump should last?
No.
Okay.
No, there really isn't. I mean, sometimes they'll last forever. It's kind of like anything. You'll talk to 10 people and you'll get 10 answers on it. Problems with fuel pumps, but as a general rule, as long as they haven't been run low on fuel, which I mentioned earlier, which is what lubricates the pump, they should last at, I would think, a minimum of 100,000 miles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I know when the fuel pump went out of my car, when they go out, they just go out. They don't give you any advance warning.
No, they don't. It's an electric motor, and it's kind of like if you've ever used an electric drill and you pulled the trigger and it didn't work and you dropped it on the floor and you picked it up and then it started working. It's kind of the same thing. So a lot of times if you're pretty certain it's a fuel pump issue, and while somebody's cranking the car, if you get under the vehicle and kick the gas tank, it's kind of like the same principle. It'll jar that motor a little bit. So there's resistance on the commutator between the brushes and the commutator, and just by jarring it, sometimes it'll start spinning again for you. But you're right. You don't get much warning.
One question. Maybe I missed part of when you were talking about lubrication, but a friend of mine, we've been having this conversation, a mechanic friend of his says never let your vehicle get below a quarter of a tank of fuel. What is your thoughts on that?
Yes, we talked about that earlier as well. Yes.
I apologize.
That's okay.
Because I do have that bad habit of running my vehicle till it gets down to E, so I am doing some damage.
Yes, you are, because that's what's lubricating the pump.
Thank you very much for your time.
Sure.
All right, thank you. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Bradley, line 3. Hello?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
We're snowbirds, and I have a 51 Tundra, and I'm thinking about how I leave that truck because we're gone for 6 months. And I always try to have the gas tank more than half full, the tires up. I pour a shot of Stabil in the gas tank and disconnect the battery ground. Should I be doing anything else?
Well, you should have the tank full, and the Stabil is a good idea.
Yeah.
You said it was a 51?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm 91. I'm sorry, okay. A 2001.
Okay. Oh, wow.
I'm getting on in years.
All right. Okay.
It's the senior moment there.
That's okay. But, yeah, the fuel tank full. Is it in a garage that the door always stays down?
With what?
Is the garage door always down?
Oh, yes.
While you're
yes.
gone? Okay. All right. The only other thing to do would be to, if you have the ability to get it off the ground, that would be ideal so that the tires aren't in contact with the ground, but a lot of times that's not possible. So
yeah, no, I don't really have any way to do that.
Right. So other than what you're doing, no. You're doing the right things.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All
sure.
Right, thank you. Next is El Paso, Illinois, line number 1. Hello.
Hello, Rick.
Yes.
I have a late model Dodge Grand Caravan. It's still under warranty.
And my question is in regards to transmission. I've had it in one time for a diagnostic check. My complaint was and still is that when approaching a stop, it seems to, this may not be the right term, downshift, not smoothly. And I took it in, they ran a diagnostic on it and said there was nothing wrong with it. But it's a different sensation than I have experienced in previous Chrysler products. And just wondered if that's something that I really should pursue.
Well, I mean, they drove it and said it felt normal to them.
I don't know that they drove it.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe just go out there and say, you know, somebody go for a ride with me and see if they... And if you still kind of question it, it sounds like you're quite familiar with these six-speed transmissions. Try to find the same year in engine car and see if while you're out there, say, is there another one of these out here somewhere that we could drive and, you know, we can make a comparison to. That would be the ideal way to answer your question.
Now, would that be same engine transmission combination in
yes.
quite a few Chrysler products?
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
Goodbye.
Over to Belgium, line number two. Hello.
Yes, how are you all today?
Good.
The lady with the light problem. I've got a problem, and I've got it in two totally different vehicles in a strange place. I have a Ford pickup truck Ranger. And the light that lets you see what channel you're on the radio, is quit. Is there any way short of tearing the dashboard out to repair that light?
Yeah, some of those, it's still the factory Ford radio.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, I think some of those, you can pull the radio out, and they have two separate bulbs for the illumination of
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
portion.
Yes,
and you can
do.
Buy those small bulbs.
I see. And I've got this, amazing as it is, I have a Honda, and the one for the clock has done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you can do similar sort of thing for them?
Correct.
Okay. I was afraid I had to get a new car.
No.
Thank you very much.
All right. Line number three, this is somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I've been having a problem with my car for some time, and the dealer's been trying to figure it out, and they can't. So I know you can't diagnose over the phone, but maybe you can help get some ideas. We took it in, and it was due for it's a Toyota Sienna 90, 95. No, I'm sorry, 2005. I'm with the gentleman, the older gentleman. And we took it in. It was time. It's got 50,000 miles now, but at the time, it was about 40,000. And it had to have the power steering fluid changed out and cleaned out and stuff like that. So that was done. We took it home, and immediately it started, like, creaking every time you turned. So the steering wheel would creak and crunch, almost like there was something that had broken. So we took it back, and they said, oh, okay, we'll recheck the power steering. Maybe that was what caused it. And they did. Nothing worked. Then they thought they twisted something with the struts somehow. I don't know how that came into play. And so they started playing with that, and they said, okay, now the noise has gone away. But within a couple of days, the noise was back. And now they're thinking it might be something related to the strut braces. I don't know. I don't even know what those are, that they've had to order them because they're just not something they keep in stock on a regular basis. So have you heard that if the Siennas have any issues along those lines or... any other ideas that would cause something to sound like a relatively new car sounding like it's going to fall apart any day?
Well, I guess we'd have to get back to this noise. I mean, it sounds to me, following your description, that it appeared immediately after you had the power steering fluid changed.
Right.
Generally, a power steering pump noise will be associated with turning the wheel. It'll sound kind of like a I don't know the best way to describe it. It won't be a squeak.
Right. It's not a squeak. It's more like a clang, not even a clang, but it's like a crunching.
Yes.
Almost.
And is it worse when it's cold?
You know, we try to listen for it at those times, you know, different times when we run it for a while, but it's really, sometimes, it's, you know, when it's worse is when it's been parked. Not necessarily that it's really cold, like it's not been overnight, but if it's just been sitting there for a little bit, and then once we're, like, you know, you're backing out, you're turning as you're backing out and stuff like that, then you really hear the crunching.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like they've determined that it's in the suspension as opposed to the power steering. Am I following you correctly?
Well, that's what they keep thinking. But they've tried some of the suspension things already, and those aren't clearing up. Mm-hmm. And now they're at the point of just kind of, I think, rebuilding the whole strut mechanism, which is kind of strange for a 50,000-mile car, I think.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very logical.
Right.
And in these situations like this, we use a stethoscope, just like the doctor does.
Okay.
And you get somebody to rotate the wheel left and right, and you use a stethoscope to localize where the noise is coming from.
And
that's really the only way I know how to diagnose these things. I mean, because to just throw parts at a car, it's not only time-consuming.
They called in an engineer to help them diagnose it all, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what he came up with, the whole strut idea thing, the suspension stuff, as opposed to the power steering or the steering mechanism. But it didn't show up until the power steering fluid was changed, mm-hmm. so I don't know why they've gone to another section of it. But
yeah, it sounds to me like it's... maybe you can get somebody to that is familiar with cars enough to, if it's as audible as you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
it almost seems like you can rest your hand on a component and feel it. But I don't know if that's true or not.
What do you mean, feel it?
Well, sometimes anytime you have a loud noise, it's usually associated with a vibration, and therefore you would feel where its source is coming from.
Okay. Hmm. All right. I don't know if they've tried that one.
Well, the stethoscope is the best.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. I never thought about that. But so you just put it like on the engine, or I mean, where do you put the, just where you think the noise is coming
from? Yeah. Oh. Exactly. And you get a pretty good sense of where it is if you just stand in front of the car and listen. Then put your head down below the bumper. You can immediately determine, is it up high or is it down low?
Okay.
And then you start diagnosing from there.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good idea. We can start at that point.
Okay.
Go from there. Thanks so much.
All right, sure.
Okay.
Next is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a Ford Mustang, and it's about a 2000. And what happens, I also have a noise, but it's a howling noise. And when my car is going really slow or rolling, the noise is, it's a squealing. And then when I pick up speed, then it's fine. So I don't know if it's the brake pads or what. What do you think that would be?
This does this every time you slow down or just when you first start out in the morning?
No, it seems like it does it most of the time if I'm going or just rolling. You know, like I park in a parking ramp, and when I'm rolling, when I first start, when I go back, it doesn't seem like it's so, it makes the noise. But when I'm going forward really slow,
mm-hmm.
and when I'm turning, a real sharp turning, it'll do it. Where do you think? Do you think it's coming from the brake somewhere?
Well, the only way to answer that question is when you hear the noise, lightly touch the brake pedal.
Well, you know, my husband pulled on my emergency brake and it stopped.
Okay, then it is associated with the rear brakes.
I have a convertible, and then I keep putting it up and down, and I'm wondering if I'm getting it in, if something's come out of round or something.
No.
Because I putting it up and down so much with the, the emergency brake?
No, that's not going to hurt anything.
You don't think that would be it, huh?
The convertible top?
Yeah. Well, no, that the emergency brake, I'm always putting it up and down the emergency
brake.
Because the car, you have to do that in order to put the top up and down.
Yes, that's correct.
And so I'm just wondering if I'm not doing it right or what.
No, you're doing that fine.
Okay.
It's not anything you're doing.
Okay.
It's just, I would just have the rear brakes looked at, because the fact that you can apply the emergency brake and the noise goes away, then you immediately know it's from the rear brakes.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, good. Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, very good.
Bye.
Well, you know, we're coming to the point here we're just going to have to stop, and I'm really sorry we have a couple of people we just can't take, but we're at the end of the time, and we got to go. For the moment, we want to say thanks very much also to Rick Karch, and I guess we'll see maybe a couple months when it's winter or getting close to winter. We'll do it again.
Hopefully that won't happen.
What, winter coming?
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything we can do about that.
All
right. Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He joins us periodically here to answer questions about cars and car care.